those stupid Pollocks.
Now, don't you think that's a little racist?
Well, damn. I guess you're right.
You're a little bit racist.
Well, you're a little bit too.
We're all a little bit racist.
I think that I would have to agree with you.
We're glad you do.
It's sad, but true. Everyone's a little bit racist.
All right.
All right.
All right.
All right.
Bigotry has never been exclusively white.
If we all could just admit that we are racist a little bit, even though we all know that it's wrong, maybe it would help us.
Good evening and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. It is Monday, December 7th, 2009. My name is James Marino, and on the call this evening, we have Matthew Murray and Peter Felicia. Peter can be read three times a week at theatermania.com and also writes for the New York Star-Ledger. Hi, Peter.
Good evening.
Also with us is Matthew Murray. Matthew is the chief theater critic for TalkinBroadway.com and also is a columnist for BroadwayStars.com. Hi, Matthew.
Hey.
All righty. So one of this week's big openings was Race. Matthew, why don't you get us started? Give us a little background on it and what you thought.
It's a David Mamet play about race. So use your imagination, basically. I have to say that I liked it quite a bit, and I'm really sort of in the minority here, judging by a lot of the other critical reaction. I was kind of joking earlier, but really, it's exactly what you would expect from a David Mamet play about this kind of subject. A lot of very sharp-edged dialogue between two lawyers, their paralegal, and this client that is being accused of rape. He is a white billionaire, and the woman he's accused of raping was a black woman, and one of the lawyers is white, one of the lawyers is black, and the paralegal is black. So there's a lot of kind of potentially charged stuff going on there. There are some fantastic exchanges between the two lawyers about the nature of the law and how it relates to race. And James Spader plays the white lawyer, and he's really excellent. He has a fantastic ear for the Mamet dialogue and for really just throwing off these little quips that say a lot without saying very much. And David Alan Greer, whom some listeners may have seen in A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum or One Touch of Venus at Encores, and who other listeners might have seen in Living Color on television once upon a time. He plays the black lawyer, and he gives a very serious performance here. There are a lot of comic aspects to it, but overall it's a very serious treatment, and he has probably the most balanced view of race and prejudice of any of the characters. Richard Thomas is the client. I wasn't really too thrilled with him. He has a really tough role, though. It's a very effete kind of, what am I going to do? Oh, I need to pander to them. Oh, no, I don't. Yes, I do. One of those types of parts that doesn't really allow for a great deal in the way of interpretation. And I thought he came across as a little bit stiff and not very believable. But again, it's a tough role. And the fourth role is played by Kerry Washington, whom I really like. I've never seen her in anything before, unfortunately. She's done mostly movies, and I haven't seen any of them. But I thought she was very good. She brought an elegance and a very good carriage to the role that really is one of those typical Mamet female roles, in that she has a large part to play, even though she's sort of underwritten and under-considered by the other characters. They think her role is one thing, and it turns out to be something very, very different. And I like that aspect of it. I think that it's really a nice treatment of a subject that's not really always so nice, and it comes at things from a very different angle than a lot of other people do. The thing that I kept thinking about while I was watching the show is that song from Avenue Q, Everyone's a Little Bit Racist, and that really is sort of what the message of the show is. It's not going to be something that's for everybody. It's not a feel-good kind of story in the traditional sense, but it's another perspective on it that I think is valuable, and I think it's very well written. I think it's up there with Mamet's best plays. It's fascinating to watch. It's good theater. I think that there's a good message to it. Maybe it could be stronger in terms of what specifically he's saying, but it's Mamet, and he has to filter everything through his own unique voice and outlook. And from that perspective, I thought that Race was really a winner.
I wasn't as enthusiastic, but nevertheless, I enjoyed it. Frankly, for me, I don't think it is what I expected from a David Mamet play, in that there were fewer interruptions and fewer staccato exchanges than we usually get in Mamet plays. That's not a criticism, it's just an observation. It's a very cold play, and it makes you come to it. That's partly in the direction.
Also,
you
know, by David Mamet.
Yes, indeed. You know, when you go to the bank and there's a big piece of glass between you and the tellers, there's almost a piece of glass there between the audience and the actors. They seem genuinely, this isn't a criticism, they seem genuinely to be talking amongst themselves. And that's good in a certain way. But somehow there needs a little bit more of a push, just a little bit more, to make us feel that we're a part of it as well. I don't think Richard Thomas is on stage for 15 minutes. I'm amazed he took the part. I guess roles are tough to get these days, but he was very good. It was something seeing David Alan Greer, who we have seen only in comic, or at least I have, only in comic parts, really be up to the challenge of a difficult dramatic role. And he did it superbly. And that was a really nice surprise. So, and James Spader, you know, I don't see that TV show that he's on particularly, but it is on before the news goes on. I'm a Channel 7 news watcher, so I've seen him at the end of that TV show he does. And yeah, he certainly had good practice for this play as a result of that. I thought the actress was commendable as well. I guess where Matthew and I part company is I wouldn't put it in the top tier of Mamet plays. It seemed lighter to me. It seemed not as pungent, but nevertheless, what really surprised me most was the distancing factor. In a way, a lot of people said this to me, I agree, it was hard to hear because they really were talking amongst themselves. And really, you don't hear that too much in Mamet plays, that they're hard to hear, because usually people are shouting tremendously. They don't hear, and again, that's a bit of a departure as well. If I were brought into the Barrymore Theatre blindfolded, and they took it off and they showed me the play and said, okay, who wrote it? Mamet wouldn't immediately come to mind to me. I don't know who would, but it wouldn't be something that would strike me as something that he would have done. It struck me more as an imitation of what he would have done. Somebody imitating him, I guess is what I should say. I wish it well. Certainly the performances are good enough. Set's a little skimpy. But I was surprised, frankly, that the reviews weren't more enthusiastic. But they most of them were on the negative side.
All right. So James Spader's television show that you alluded to, Boston Legal, I think actually wrapped up last season at the end of the season. I'm not sure about that. I think so. I think it did. And actually, Spader actually had a handful of musical theater people on that show. Meredith Patterson was on that show with Spader. She played the wife of Tom Selleck, who was a client on the show. And there was some musical theater moments on there. So
she had a recurring role?
She had a recurring role for...
Oh, good for her. She was so good at Follies at Paper Mill.
Episodes or so. Anyway, good for them. I'm glad to see. And James Spader's really... He got some really good airtime on Boston Legal, and he got some Emmys and things like that. So maybe it'll bring a new audience to Broadway to come see him in that show. He got quite a following in Boston Legal.
Yeah,
so,
one thing I do want to say regarding that is it's really nice to see a cast of people who are mostly TV and film stars who really are able to do quite well in what is really a very kind of play. So I think that, yeah, I think that obviously David Mamet knew what he wanted and wasn't going to screw it up too much. But it's nice to see that there were a lot of screen people on stage who didn't have to fumble and who didn't make basic mistakes, but who all knew what they were doing and how to get there.
Another show that's actually opening this evening is So Help Me God, and Matthew and Peter got a chance to see it. So, Peter, why don't you go first this time?
Well, this is by Maureen Dallas Watkins, who wrote the play Chicago, on which the celebrated musical is based. And, you know, for years, I assume she was a one-shot wonder because, you know, yeah, Chicago was a famous play in its day in the 20s. But, you know, what else has she done? Who's heard of anything? Well, there was this play that did get a little bit of a tryout. Not in Philly, Boston, or Baltimore, but on the subway circuit that used to happen in Brooklyn and places like that, they used to try out not so far out of town. And this play got that type of tryout in 1929, and it didn't come in. The Depression was blamed, but it was more than that, apparently. And what we have here is a revisal of the play. It's not quite the play that happened in 1929, but Jonathan Bank, who runs the Mint Theater Company, one of my favorite places in the city, decided to do it. He edited it. He claims he hasn't added or distorted her language, but really just took out a little bit too much. My hat is off to the Mint. I mean, this is a play that has 15 people in it, and some of them are barely used. I mean, it's amazing. Small parts. But you're paying 15 salaries, and it didn't stop him from doing it. You go into the theater. There's, you know, you expect to see a proscenium march at the Lortel Theater, but they've covered the entire proscenium march with photographs of famous actresses' eyes, close-up of their eyes. And again, an expense they didn't need. And because this is a backstage story about a tempestuous star, you got to dress her up in many different gowns. And that costs money, too. And, well, they spent it. And they also got a name actress to play the part of Lily Darnley, who's believes that it is her divine right and privilege to be worshipped by one and all as a great star. And playing this role is a lady who gave a performance a few years ago that was very controversial. I liked it quite a bit. Kristen Johnson. I liked her very much as Sabina in The Skin of Our Teeth, and try to find anybody else who will agree with that. But you know, it was funny because my girlfriend and I were sitting there, and we were trying to figure out who the eyes over the proscenium arch were. And the one right above center stage, I think Lauren Bacall's eyes. And it's interesting because Kristen Johnston is almost our version of Lauren Bacall, the current day Lauren Bacall. I can see her doing applause very easily. She does have that statuesque grandeur and those looks that are beautiful, but striking more than beautiful, you know. So, but boy, does she throw herself into this part of a woman who truly believes that it is the world's responsibility to love everything she does. And what's so fascinating is that she doesn't want to do a play. What she wants to do is a vehicle for her. All she's interested in is how she's going to come across and how impressive she's going to be to everybody. And not only that, she wants to play a character that is nothing like herself. She wants to play this noble, kind, suffering woman. But the irony is the play the playwright has written is perfect for her as is. The character he's written, we get little bits and pieces of it, is really right for this vain, egocentric monster. She is a monster because there's a moment in the play that involves a firing that is pretty surprising and pretty hair-raising on its own merits. So she really runs into that and grabs that moment in a very clever way. I've never seen anybody fire anybody and get away with it with no responsibility attached whatsoever. It's a marvelous thing. What's also marvelous is the title, So Help Me God. I mean, we have an image in our head how that's said. You know, I'm not going to say what you may be thinking, but you have it within your rights to think of what, when somebody says, so help me God, how do you picture it being said? Well, you will hear it said that way, but you're also going to hear it said a completely different way. And that's kind of fascinating as well. They're both said by the young actress who comes in to play a supporting role in the show. And when you are in a play with Lily Darnley, you're playing a supporting role. That's a given. So there's a little All About Eve about it, in a sense, though it was written more than two decades before All About Eve. There is something about that that's kind of interesting as well. A great play, certainly not. But boy, does this lady, Maureen Dallas Watkins, did she have an ear for dialogue, and did she know the theater and the personalities that go into it and how people are ambitious and get discouraged and become ambitious all over again? She got all that very right. I had a wonderful time.
I pretty much agree with Peter. The from the very beginning when he said that he thought that Jonathan Bank cut too much, I would agree with that. I've never read the original play, and I don't know if anyone has, because supposedly it was lost forever and never published and anything like that. So I have no idea what it's originally like, but I thought there were all sorts of places here where you could see cut marks and tape holding things together and pages that have been rearranged and all that. I just, especially in the last act, I felt, well, I'm sorry, let me rephrase that. In the quote-unquote second scene of Act 2, which I think we all know originally was intended to be Act 3, there are a lot of things that happen that don't really have easy explanations, and you have to work a little bit harder for them. I feel like he either cut out a lot of kind of the connecting tissue of Act 2, Scene 2, or he cut out the stuff that set it up, because I just thought that parts of the scene leading up to the ending were not very satisfying, even though the ending itself was absolutely correct given the plot. And other than that, I agree with pretty much everything that Peter says. I do want to drop the name of the actress, Anna Klumsky, who plays the young woman who becomes Lily's understudy and plays the supporting role, who, of course, ends up getting better reviews for one performance only. And she does very well. She had a brief movie career in the 90s, and she really has matured into a very good stage actress. If I didn't know who she was, I don't think I would have been able to recognize her, because she really melted into the kind of period hairstyle and clothes that everyone had to wear. And look, as Peter said, the Mint Theater Company, as they are wont to do, really did spend the money and take the time to get everything looking as elegant and special as it would have been had this been produced back in 1929. I really was not especially thrilled with the supporting cast. In fact, aside from the two women, I really don't have much good to say about anybody. I don't really have anything bad to say about anybody, but it was a lot of very functional people, which in a way is appropriate, because Lily is not going to have anyone in her play who stands her up. It is a difficult play to sort of sell, and I wish that there had been a little bit more honesty in the roles. There was a fair amount that seemed to be on the border of caricature and sometimes crossing the border. And just the supporting actors had distinguished themselves a little bit more. But it's a fascinating play. I agree that it's probably not a great play, but it's really a strong play and an interesting play. And it really does tell you more about the kind of writer and the kind of visionary type person that Maureen Dallas Watkins was. And it certainly has gotten me interested in reading even more of her writing besides the now two plays that everyone has a chance of knowing.
Yeah, I'm hoping they'll bring back Revelry, a play I didn't know anything about until I read in the program about it, because that was written about Warren G. Harding and his corrupt administration. I've always found Warren G. Harding a fascinating character, and I hope I can live till 2014 when all his letters to his mistress and hers to him can be made public for the first time. But Lawrence and Lee wrote a play about Warren G. Harding. They changed the name, but it was Warren G. Harding they were writing about in the 50s, called The Gang's All Here. But I imagine Maureen Dallas Watkins did a better job of capturing what was happening at the time, because she was there. She was observing what was happening in the Harding administration with the Teapot Dome scandal and Judge Crater and all that stuff that was going on then. So I hope they bring that one back. But what's also interesting, too, is one again has to wonder about these plays that closed out of town. You know, how many were...
Well, this one closed in town, technically, didn't it?
I guess it did, yes.
Sorry.
Yes, out of borough.
Yes.
An out of borough closing. So, I mean, there's a book called Broadway Bound. It has nothing to do with Neil Simon, but it's about plays that did try out and didn't make it in. And the author includes descriptions, and some of them are really hilarious. I mean, let's take Carrot and Club, a 1947 show that closed out of town. Here's the description. Kit Trevor, who lost a hand in World War II, returns to Los Angeles and attempts to get his cartoon strip, Johnny Vet, syndicated. There's something about that that just sounds like it's not going to be a winner. Or Death Comes at Sunset. Princess Sandra Carew, a Hindu vampire, arrives in London seeking revenge on the Blair family for Philip Blair's killing of a fellow vampire in India. You know, even then vampire shows weren't going over. I mean, you know, so it's kind of interesting. But some of them may have been as good as this, you know, and if so, I'd love to get a chance to see some of them.
All right. Also opening is The Heart is a Lonely Hunter at New York Theater Workshop. Matthew, why don't you start us off on that?
Yeah, this is an adaptation of the original first major Carson McCullers novel about a town in Georgia with a deaf man who sort of makes a difference in the lives of the people around him, but can't convince them that he also might have the kinds of problems that they come to him to talk about. I have to say, I didn't think there's really a lot to say about this. It's a relatively straight adaptation of the book, which I admittedly have not read, but it's very straightforward. It doesn't take a lot of chances, but it does what so many plays do when they try to adapt something, that they take something that's 400 pages long and they try to make it 2.5 hours long. And as a result, you get a lot of really short scenes that undoubtedly have an extreme amount of significance to the novel if you've read it. But if you're watching it, you're just like, well, why did they spend 5 seconds showing that guy play the banjo or whatever? And it doesn't really add up from that standpoint. It's okay. It's not poorly acted. Henry Stram, who a lot of people might remember from being in the Michael John Lacusen musical See What I Want to See at the Public Theater, he plays the deaf man. It does a very good job. There was a bit of a controversy going into rehearsals that because he's not actually deaf, he should not be playing one of the classic deaf roles of American literature. And we didn't talk about this on the show a few weeks back when we discussed whether that kind of thing was appropriate. We talked specifically about The Miracle Worker, but a lot of the same problems were kind of cropping up here. And the playwright Rebecca Gilman had conceived it from the beginning as one for a hearing actor who would narrate his story at the beginning and the end, but in the middle would just speak in sign language and writing things down. And I don't know if that necessarily matters that much. She said in an interview in the Times, I think, that she was considering revising it to make it more playable by people who themselves can't hear. And there's probably value in that. I don't think that the work itself is really that terrific. There are so many different stories and there's not enough time to deal with them. There's the black doctor who wants his children to grow up and be more than maids and ruffians, and the little girl who lives in the, not that little, but the 14-year-old girl who lives in the boarding house with the deaf guy who wants to compose symphonies and doesn't understand sex and all of that. It's you don't get enough of an opportunity to understand any of the people or what they're going through, and there's so much time spent on them. You don't really get to know the deaf guy either, and he's the center of the story. So it feels like it's really kind of an adaptation looking for its heart. And because it doesn't find it, I did not find it particularly satisfying to watch. I wasn't exactly bored by it. I wasn't upset. I wasn't outraged. I wasn't anything. It was just, it was sort of there, and there were some very nice moments when Henry Stram was allowed to be himself and act out this very conflicted character who becomes a sounding board for all these other people's problems. But aside from that, I didn't take a lot away from it. If you are really a Carson McCullers fan, it's possible that you should check it out and see how it measures up to the book. But otherwise, it's nothing special.
I liked it more than that, but here's the point I'd like to make. At intermission, I went out into the lobby and I ran into another critic. I'm not going to say who, but this guy was apoplectic. And he said, Oh, yeah, do you know this novel? And I said, no. He said, oh, this is a travesty of the novel. I'm not saying she did a bad job. I'm saying this is a burlesque. This is a travesty. She got everything wrong. Everything. I'm just so incensed, you know, so on and so forth. And that's fine. I'm not criticizing him at all. That's not the point of why I bring this up. What I bring up is that for those of us who don't know the novel, we're obviously going to have a very different experience. And I went there only knowing a little bit of the movie. To be perfectly frank, when the movie came out in the late 60s, I went to a drive-in movie theater one night. And this story is not going to be nearly as interesting as it seems to be starting out to be. But the picture was about halfway through when I arrived. And so I only picked it up from the middle. Alan Arkin was playing the Henry Stram role here. And I got the point of it, that indeed, here's a man whom everybody burdens with their troubles, not giving a thought to he might have some troubles of his own. And so I understood the point of it. But I have no idea if indeed the movie was a good version of the novel either. But if people love the novel, perhaps they're going to agree with this critic and really have a tough time. So I bring that up as a cautionary piece of advice. For those of us who don't know it, well, I have to say I was very interested in it, mostly because of that young teenage girl. That character I adored, because here was a girl who was part of a very poor family. And as a result, she used to run around the neighborhood and hide in bushes so she could listen to the other people's radios. She doesn't have a radio in her house. And this is the closest way, the only way, that she can get any culture whatsoever. And I just love somebody who works that hard to get culture. I thought that was fabulous. Also, she talks about that she doesn't spend her lunch money on lunch, but that she is learning to play music from a friend who knows how to play the piano. She pays her for piano lessons. So that type of character is going to be tremendously interesting to me. Now, some might say, wait a minute, wait. You're supposed to be interested in the deaf guy. And if so, yes, maybe my focus was pulled by that. But nevertheless, I was grateful to see a young girl so interested in the finer things in life. And that carried me a long way with this play. I was really riveted to her. So for that reason alone, I had a very good time. But in terms of making the point that indeed the guy is somebody who's a sounding board and nobody ever says, do you have any problems? Would you like to talk about something? Would you like to write down your problems? And we're all so self-centered that we don't think about that the other person, whom we assume is just having a marvelous life. That's of interest to me, too.
All right. This Sunday, Little Night Music opens at the Walter Kerr. And so I guess maybe we'll talk about that next week or the week after. We're coming into the holiday season, and our schedules are all kind of iffy. So as always, just if you subscribe to Broadway Radio and This Week on Broadway, you can automatically get the podcasts when they come into your podcast player whenever we make a new one. So just keep your eye out for us. One of the things I saw in the headlines tonight that that Roundabout is looking for a new tenant for the Henry Miller. And I thought that was interesting, and I hadn't really thought about that. If you know, Birdie's going to come up short into what they anticipated was going to be in that space, I guess they need to fill that to pay the bills and keep the lights on and everything there. And also in the headlines tonight, I saw that Al Pacino is going to be in Merchant of Venice in Central Park. Peter, have you seen Al Pacino in anything live?
Yes, way back in 1967. He was just starting out, and he was doing Awake and Sing at the Charles Playhouse in Boston. And frankly, his name didn't make any impression on me. I mean, I remember thinking that the guy who played the young part in Awake and Sing in that production was very good. But it was only a few years ago that I realized it was he. I was filing playbills from the last Awake and Sing production we had on Broadway, what, 2 or 3 years ago?
3 years.
It was three. So, yeah. I mean, I was filing and I saw the playbill from 1969. Let's see who's in it. You know, oh my God, it was Al Pacino. So that was kind of interesting. I also remember him in Does a Tiger Wear a Necktie, which was his breakout role on Broadway. And frankly, I felt like I was watching Dustin Hoffman. I thought they looked alike, and I thought they acted a lot alike, and that was kind of interesting to me as well. He also came to Boston and did Richard III a few years before he did it on Broadway, and I thought he was quite good in that. So yeah, I have a long history with him. And of course, I did see the movie version of Merchant of Venice that he did, where he played Shylock, and thought he was quite good. I didn't like that it was so heavily edited, but nevertheless, I did like his performance quite a bit, and I'm looking forward to this. People have a lot of issues with Merchant of Venice as being anti-Semitic, and I understand that, but I would love to see a revised Merchant of Venice where, after Portia gives her a speech and entreats on Shylock to give in, that suddenly the scene ends and we go right into the whole business with the rings and Nerissa and all that stuff that goes on there. Happy ending. I don't want to see Shakespeare humiliated in court. I would like to see, give the implication that the speech works on him, the quality of mercy, and he gives in. So that's my favorite Merchant of Venice, which I guess I'll never see. But I'm certainly looking forward to seeing Merchant of Venice under any circumstances, because way back when I was 14 years old, in a galaxy far, far away, it was the first Shakespeare I ever read, and it was the one that made me want to read all the others. So this will be a big event for me.
Did you see Huey or Salome?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Sure. It's nice that Pacino is one of those actors who really, truly does come back to the theater from time to time, that he knows the value of it and understands that you got to keep those muscles sharp. And the only way you can do that is by exercising them. They weren't plays that I particularly liked, but I like the fact that he was doing them. He does what he believes in, and that's always very good.
So something that we've been talking about in the last couple of weeks, and now the New York Times is talking about, is the grosses for Ragtime and Finian's Rainbow seem to be struggling in these days of... one of the other things we didn't talk about was a few weeks ago, Wicked had its first $2 million gross. So you have, it was the best of times and it was the worst of times on Broadway for some of these shows that are just merely blocks apart. So the Ragtime grossed $480,000. And Finian's Rainbow also was in that range. Finian's Rainbow grossed $589,000. And these are no longer numbers that can keep shows open, whereas, you know, 10 years ago, this would have been a pretty respectable gross, $589,000.
It's funny you mention that, because I was just watching the movie of the original producers, because I'm doing a thing at Barnes & Noble on Wednesday night on Zero Mostel, and I'm moderating a panel. So I've been watching everything that I can about Zero Mostel. And when they zero in, no pun intended, on the ad in Variety for Springtime for Hitler casting, you may recall, you know, seeking someone to play Hitler, no previous experience necessary. Do you remember that? They actually have it on the page of Variety that shows the grosses. And there's Hallelujah Baby, you know, at 67,000, and Cabaret at 60,000, and stuff like that. And it's really astonishing to see what grosses once were. There would have been a time when people would have danced in the street for $480,000 grosses, but those days are long gone, I'm sorry to say. Ragtime and Finian's Rainbow, we're having a tough time of it. It's at the risk of sounding bitter and cynical, it's harder for intelligent shows today than it used to be, and shows that really make you listen. And these are shows that do that. So I'm sorry for their struggles. I hope it turns around. I don't necessarily believe it will, but I think both deserve to succeed.
Well, so, Mike Riedel wrote a column last week or the week before in which he had talked about the producers of Ragtime pretty much being ready to throw in the towel because they had not been doing very well. And I personally do not think that Ragtime is very good, and I don't think that the reason it's failing has anything to do with the fact that it's an intelligent show. I think it has to do with the fact that it closed on Broadway less than 10 years ago. This is a regional theater production that looks like it, is cast like it, and is not treated with the with the Broadway solution or whatever you want to call it that really would bring people to the theater and get them excited. Finian's Rainbow, I feel sorrier for because I think it's better, but again, it's really tough because it's kind of a semi full production. It's an adaptation of an encore show that still looks like it used to be an encore show, and I think that it's really tough for people to want to pay for stuff like that looks like it's not really all the way there. Whereas if you go see something like Wicked or Mary Poppins, or I don't agree with this, but I suppose compared to the other two, Billy Elliot, that you're getting something more for your money than merely something that looks like it was designed for five performances or that was made up of leftover balustrades from some set that the Kennedy Center did. It's really a tough situation, and I feel bad when good shows don't succeed, but I'm not convinced The Ragtime is good, and I don't, as I believe I said on the podcast back in May, I don't think that it was ever wise to bring it to Broadway in the first place. Finian's Rainbow, it's a good show, but you know, if you've got a girl in green makeup, that's probably about the only kind of person of color that young teenage girls are really gonna care that much about. And maybe that doesn't say much about racist chances, because obviously both of these shows and Superior Donuts, which also deals with the relationship between a black man and a white man, maybe that's really not what people want to see right now. I don't know. Time will tell. But I certainly hope things turn around for Finian's Rainbow, because I think it's almost good enough, and that's still better than a lot of the revivals we see these days.
Well, you know, it's always such a complicated thing, because to quote, to paraphrase a line from a play we were just talking about, the devil concites scripture to serve his purpose. And I can do that with saying, wow, you know, well, Jersey Boys has one of the ugliest sets in the history of mankind, you know, and certainly hasn't hurt it any. So there are all, I guess what I'm really trying to say here is not that I'm right or Matthew's right or anything like that, but there are so many complicated reasons why shows succeed or fail. And indeed, sure, Ragtime was on Broadway not that long ago, but it wasn't all that appreciated then, frankly. And
it ran 2 years, though. That's not significant amount of time.
No, that's not. And there was a time when
it went on two national tours. It had sit-down productions in Los Angeles, Vancouver, and Chicago. It's been all over the place. People have seen it. This is not a case of something like Finian's Rainbow. Well, but even Finian's Rainbow's had a fair number of productions. But Ragtime has, I think, been oversaturated in putting it back on Broadway after all of those major productions within a decade. I think was probably not a smart business idea.
Personally. It may not have been, but the point I wanted to make was that even when it first came out, it wasn't all that appreciated. I mean, it certainly lost the Tony Award to The Lion King, and I certainly think it's a stronger show than The Lion King. The first 10 minutes or whatever it is of The Lion King are really astonishing. For that matter, I think the first 10 minutes of Ragtime are pretty astonishing too, even in this production, though I do think the original production was stronger in that opening number. I like
the original production was a lot stronger in that opening number because it was staged and it was choreographed and it was designed, and this has a lot of people marching on stairways. And to me, it was not very visually interesting. But yeah, I agree with you that the people have been talking about this ever since 1998 when The Lion King and Ragtime were up against each other. And I saw the original productions of both of those shows. And yeah, if you just pay attention to the first 10 minutes of The Lion King, it deserved to win Best Musical. Now, if you paid attention to anything that happened from minute 11 onward, it didn't deserve anything, but it had that magic that the original production of Ragtime only had in comparison to this revival. Ragtime has a wonderful score and has very good things in it, but it didn't overall capture the kind of Broadway magic that people really think of and that they got from The Lion King. And it's too bad, but it's one of those things that happens.
But there, even back then, I think people were looking for more escapist entertainment. And Ragtime demands a lot of you. It does. Ironically enough, I decided to read the novel again, And I'm a, where am I? I am just at the point where the firemen are harassing Kohlhaas. I'm up to that point. And it's fascinating to see the subtle differences in what they took and what they dropped. What really interested me is that the scene in which Kohlhaas plays the piano in the musical and Sarah come down to me when he sings that, she does. In the novel, in fact, she doesn't. She's still angry. It takes him a lot longer to do that. So I thought that was very smart of the musical to condense that. The Wheels of a Dream sequence is only vaguely alluded to, so I was very impressed at how the writers made something more of that. And so I liked that quite a bit indeed. And it was very interesting, too, that the mother of, meaning Tata's wife, is a character in the novel, and we don't see her in the musical. She's a woman who is unfaithful to her husband, and he throws her out. That happens in the movie, but it doesn't happen in the stage show. So this
Sort of referred to in the musical in that Tata never actually says, "Well, the mother died." No, your mother is dead to us. They don't get into that, but that
no, they don't.
That is what happens. So that is kind of there, but again, you're only going to pick up on it if you've read the novel.
Indeed.
That's only because Garth left her out because she was going to be part of the spinoff of it.
Ah.
You know, in his grandiose plans for Ragtime.
Time it's personal. Yeah.
Ragtime 2, the European edition. You know, it's Mother back in the shtetl.
Matthew, where does that come from? I forget. This Time It's Personal.
I have no idea.
Oh, this really? Time It's Personal is from
just,
a...
It's just it's some dumb a, movie cliche
it,
thing.
It's from a Sylvester Stallone movie. It's
oh,
like,
that is?
It's like, it, yeah, it was like, and this time it's personal.
It in rang a bell, but I couldn't place it.
In a world where musicals are king.
I wish there were a world where musicals were king, you know, but it was funny. There was a line in So Help Me God that was something like, you know, it's so hard to get a straight play on now or something like that deep in the third act, Matthew. And you know, I thought, well, that much hasn't really changed. It still is harder for straight plays to do well. So
for the record, according to Wikipedia, it's from Jaws the Revenge.
Oh, is that right? Look at that.
Really?
I can understand why you'd confuse Sylvester Stallone with a shark, though. That makes perfect sense to me. So I understand.
I'm pretty sure, and this time it's personal. It definitely was used in Jaws if the Wikipedia says so, but
yes.
I remember it being associated with like a Rambo-type Sylvester Stallone movie, if not Over the Top, which I can't believe nobody has musicalized yet. Do you guys know Over the Top?
No, do you, Matthew?
No, I don't.
Sylvester Stallone movie about arm wrestling. Sylvester Stallone is a truck driver who arm wrestles on the side, and he's got to win this arm wrestling match to win back the respect of his daughter or something along these lines.
Sounds like a good show for him.
Yeah, Angela Lansbury will be in it next month. So we were talking about grosses with Ragtime and Finian's, and Fellas, grosses, while they're filling a lot of seats, their grosses are pretty low in comparison to their potential. And then we get this news on top of it that some of the members of Fella got injured and they had to cancel a show last night. That was Sunday night. But they're supposed to be back in the saddle this week. But
James, I hadn't heard about that. What happened?
Yeah, it said that... Daniel DeSoto hurt his wrist, and Nicole DeWeaver was elbowed in the eye, and she had to go to the emergency room.
Where did this happen? On stage?
On stage, yeah. And Corey Baker, he got back spasms, and so I don't know if they're all going in talking about the Scottish play and all this is coming back to them. But actually tonight... Monday night, they're going to be performing on the Colbert Report. But obviously, this podcast won't be out in time for people to listen to that. But maybe you can catch it on the Colbert Report's website. You can see.
Or if you TiVo, this will give you more inducement to check your TiVo out sooner rather than later. That's entirely possible, too. You know what I find interesting about Fela's advertising? I've seen handbills now that on the front have a quotation from John Simon, and on the back have a quotation from Ben Brantley. Now, I would have thought that Ben Brantley would have raided the front of, and certainly they have a wonderful quote from him. How could they not? His review was really quite enthusiastic, one of the most enthusiastic I've seen from him. But it's interesting to me that they choose an intranet presence rather than newspaper presence to put on the front of their advertising handout. I wonder if that's a sign of the times. No pun intended.
Well, you know, I guess they're shooting for a specific audience that
sure.
that the quote is more important than the quote is more important than the source.
Yeah, Fela will have to run. It just has to with reviews like that. It's going to be interesting to see what type of success it's going to be. Will it be a Spring Awakening success? And it's in the same theater, ironically enough, which means that it wins awards. It gets great reviews. And the public comes to it, not in droves, but certainly enough to keep it around. Out of the 114 weeks that Spring Awakening was on Broadway, it sold out 5, which is astonishing to me for a show that wins 8 Tony Awards, including Best Musical. So we'll see if Fela can do better.
So other news that's out there is that Kelsey Grammer's coming in. I guess the Lacage people have figured out that we need a star in these roles to keep shows open. I've never seen Kelsey Grammer on stage, have you?
Yeah, he did Macbeth, right?
Yeah.
That's that guy,
oh,
right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. He did Macbeth. I didn't
and
see that.
He did that My Fair Lady concert at the Philharmonic last year
right.
or the year before.
Yeah. How was he, Matthew?
Pretty good. I mean, it's one of those things. He probably didn't have enough rehearsal time. I had some issues with him, but I think that he would actually be pretty good casting in a full production with a longer rehearsal period. I think he's very good on stage, and he's certainly if you've known him from Cheers and Frasier and some of his TV work, he has an affinity for singing, and he has a very theatrical acting style. So I think that he could be good, and I am slightly more interested in seeing the Lacage now than I was. I still think it's silly to bring it here since, again, less than a decade ago, we still had it. We had a production of it, but this production is supposed to be more realistic and gritty and all that, so who knows?
Well, what's interesting is, of course, that he's taking a role that isn't truly the starring role.
Right.
And what's interesting about that is that he must understand the people who come to see him are going to come and then come away saying, gee, he was good, but oh, that guy played the other part. Wow. Because that's what's going to happen. He will get them in to the theater, and that's very nice. And I'm sure they won't be disappointed per se. I think that they'll just, it's not that they'll like him less, but that they'll like the other guy more.
Well, there was also that suggestion in Michael Riedel's column when he wrote about this, again, either last week or the week before, that eventually Kelsey Grammer might take over the other role, the Al Bann role. And I don't know if that's ever happened with Lacage, but that would certainly be an interesting way to match the star with the part, because I don't know the exact actor's equity ruling, but if there's something in there saying that if somebody comes in from England or whatever, they can only play the role for a limited period of time and then it has to be taken over by an American actor. So it's possible. Who knows?
That would be great. I love when things like that happen.
Yeah, I do too. I feel like, from what I know of Kelsey Grammer's singing voice, he doesn't have quite what we would associate with George Hearn or some of the other people who've played that role. He does have a voice, but it's not that sort of huge Gary Beach sort of sound that you got in the revival or George Hearn in the original. And that it would be a shame to lose that, I think, because especially with I Am What I Am, it's a really wonderful big sort of sound that gives you a certain feeling for that character and what he's going through. And if you don't have that, I don't know. But I think that certainly for the other role, George, I believe, is the name of the character that Kelsey Grammer would be more than sufficient. But I would like to see someone who's a bit more vocally appropriate take on the role. But if Kelsey Grammer could get him in the theater, I mean, Lacage is a pretty good show. So I don't know. We'll see what happens. It could just be, talk, because sometimes that's all it is. But
I personally am waiting to see if they can perhaps get David Hyde Pierce and Kelsey Grammer both in Lacage at the same time.
Now that would be I think, box office dynamite.
I think
any show, it wouldn't even need to be LeCage, but get the two of them on stage together in an actual play, and they could both do it. I'm sure they both have musical experience. They both have, you know, legit acting experience. So I can't believe someone hasn't come up with that idea already.
Do The Odd Couple.
Oh no, that. But yeah, who? But which one of them would play Oscar? I don't really see either of them.
They could switch in the middle.
Maybe, but they both seem like Felix to me.
Yeah, that would be very funny.
It's very interesting when The Odd Couple started out, and I saw its second performance in Boston, that Art Carney was playing Felix, because Art Carney at that point in time was most famous for playing a guy who worked in the sewer. And I just find it very interesting that they didn't worry about the fact that he was known to America as a guy who worked in sewers. And now suddenly he was playing this fastidious neatnik. So I've always found that very interesting. And it's the one thing people never remember about The Odd Couple, that Art Carney was the original Felix. Because Walter Matthau, you know, ran rampant, ramshod, and every other R word I can think of with the show. So it really became Matthau's vehicle. And of course, Carney didn't get to do the movie.
Well, you know, talk to Cheetah about that.
I suppose you're right.
Doing the movie. We all know that. All righty. So I guess that's it for this week.
All right.
So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts, as I mentioned before, by going to the front page of BroadwayStars.com. And on the right-hand side, there's a Broadway Radio link to subscribe. That way, every time there's a new show, it'll automatically download into your iTunes player. And then you can move it, listen to it on your computer, or take it with you on your iPod, your iPhone, anything that starts with the I, letter I. Also, if you want to reach out and touch us, you can send us some feedback at the front page of BroadwayStars.com, the contact form, or you can call us and leave a voicemail at 646-873-7695, and perhaps we'll play it on the show. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Matthew Murray, this is James Marino saying thank you so much for listening to Broadway Radios This Week on Broadway. Good night.
Night.
Bye, everybody.
Me too.
Me too.
Everyone's a little bit racist, it's true. But everyone's just about as racist as you. If we all could just admit that we are racist a little bit, and everyone stop being so PC.
A little bit racist.